supporting me when I needed it most. I went into divorce court saying that I was a high-income earner, and despite whatever my attorney said in the filings, the court should give her whatever they saw fit. Now, when the decision was made, I didn't argue. I didn't debate. I just said, okay, Your Honor. I don't know why it took me so long to go through with the divorce. I guess I hadn't expected to fall in love again. Chapter 87. If you never talk to strangers, you never talk to anyone, since everyone is a stranger before you talk to them. That was deep. That was actually deep. Here's another way that something that seems negative can be interpreted positively. If people are saying critical things about you, it means you're worth talking about. And if they're wrong about you, even better, because it means that you're worth making stuff up about. See, with Laugh at My Pain, it no longer made sense to follow the same plan of recording a show and selling it to Comedy Central. A third cable special would be a lateral move, not an upward move. It wouldn't get me anywhere. I decided to raise the bar and release the special as a theatrical film rather than a television program. I knew very little about the business side of movies, so when I asked people what they thought of the idea, they said some variation of, what did they say? Oh, that's right. Shut up, Kev. You're dumb. That's what they said. That's what Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor and all the greats did. Why is it dumb for me to do it? Because you don't know nothing about releasing a movie. That was true. Then again, I gotten this far by being willing to stretch myself. See, around the time you're 18, nature stops the process of growing in your body. So if you want to keep growing after that, you have no choice but to stretch yourself on your own and increase your thinking, your capabilities, and your accomplishments. It's a scary thing to take the risk and make sacrifices necessary to keep growing. But it's better than living a life in which you don't fulfill your potential. The worst case scenario is that it doesn't work. The best case scenario is that it does. Whatever happens, life goes on, and so does laughter. I formed a production company, Heartbeat Productions, and I began working towards this new goal. You only learn by doing. Everyone's inexperienced when they start anything new. One morning, I was at the Los Angeles airport waiting for a flight to a Laugh in My Pain show when a cocky guy with a great wall of teeth came up to me. It looked like he put a lot of care into his appearance. Each item of his clothing, from his black fedora to his brown dress shoes, were impeccable, but none of it matched. I remember thinking, that's the best worst-dressed guy I've ever seen in my life. Hey, Kevin. He stuck out his hand. I'm a movie producer, and I've had a lot of success. I'd love to sit down with you for a second. Okay. He sat down next to me and introduced himself as Will Packer. Then he told me about the movies he'd done. Takers, Obsessed, Stomp the Yard. I got another movie in the works right now, he went on. I would love to talk to you and just have a general conversation. I thought for a moment about whether I wanted to exchange phone numbers with him, then decided that it couldn't hurt. When he reached out the next day, I told him that I didn't have time to meet, but he could drop by one of my shows if he wanted to. I didn't think anything would come of it, so I didn't tell my manager or agents about it. But just like with the Shaq special, I was wrong. Often, it's been the opportunities I most undervalue in life that end up providing the most value. Will hopped on a plane to Dallas the next day and came to my show there. The next morning, we met for breakfast. As could be expected with anyone who approached me in an airport to pitch doing business together, he was a talker. He began by telling me that he'd been following my career and was aware of everything that I've been doing. Then he made his pitch. But it was all hypothetical statements, vague promises, and future hype. This is going to be real big, and if you wanted to be a part of this, I got you. In these situations, I don't necessarily focus on what someone says. I look at who they are, and Will seemed to have a lot of attributes that I shared. Things that had gotten me to where I was. He was a people person. He was passionate and dedicated to his craft. He seemed like a hard worker, and like me, there was nothing he felt that he couldn't handle or do. I've worked with Clint Culpepper over at Screen Gems, and we do great business, big movies. This is what he was telling me. I want you to star in this movie I'm putting together. I got the rights to Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man. In Steve Harvey's book, it was a huge bestseller. Honestly, it was a phenomenon. Biggest book of dating advice for women out there. Have you read it? I told him, I said, I'm not exactly the target audience. Well, here's a copy. Read it, let me know what you think, and if you want to be involved. I really do think you're the guy for it. Okay? He said, I should have a script and stuff soon, but I just want to know if you're interested. If you are, I could put this thing together and make amazing things happen for you. He showed me a bunch of numbers about how profitable the movie could be. I felt like I'd heard this story before, but I was willing to take the chance that maybe Maybe this time it will have a different ending. I hope your word is as good as you say it is. That's what I declared as we parted ways that day. All I know is how to deliver, baby. Whatever amount of confidence that response was intended to instill in me, it accomplished the exact opposite. I read the book that night. Rather than seeing it as a betrayal of men, like some guys did, I respected most of the advice. For example, the part about how it was important to understand a man's dedication to his career goals. There was also a section about waiting 90 days to give a man the cookie, as Steve Harvey calls it. I wonder if Inigo had used this tactic on me. If she had, then I owe this book a lot. I called Will back the next day. Hey, man, so who else is going to be in the movie? Right now? Brother, you're the talk of the town. I wanted to get you first and then build around you. Well, you got me, Will. Let's build it. Great. That's good news. Listen, I'll send you the script as soon as it comes. I didn't hear from him for a while, and the project faded from my mind until Will called out of the blue one day. We're ready. The Thing Like a Man script is done. It's incredible. You'll love it. I want to get it to you. You're our anchor on this, man. I read it, called him back the next day, and told him the writer had done an amazing job of turning a self-help book into an ensemble dating comedy. Great, he responded. Then we're going to start casting this so we can shoot this baby. You might not want to use that expression. He said, look, man, you funny. All right, you're a genius. Let's knock this thing out the park. Who should I talk to? Who's your representative? I never actually told Dave Becky about Will. I wanted to wait until it was real, and now it was. In the meantime, I had some serious instigating to do. Chapter 88, Keeping My Guardian Angel Busy. Now, since the shows had moved up to theaters and arenas, there was constantly money in my pocket. So what happens when a risk taker who's not good with money gets a lot of cash? He does dumb shit with it. Most of that involved getting someone on my team to do something stupid. It all started when we were at Fuddruckers somewhere in the South. I bet Wayne $300 that he couldn't eat 2 1-pound burgers without throwing up. The cocky motherfucker ordered his 2 burgers and bacon and mayo with the works. Halfway through the second one, he started feeling sick, and by the last bite, we could see him working to control his gag reflex. He won the money, then he lost it all a few days later by pouring a shitload of vodka into a red plastic cup and betting me $300 that I couldn't drink it all. Now, I may be short, but I have the liver of a tall man. Back then, I could down 12 shots and still get on stage and perform without missing a beat. I won that 300, but the next morning, I had a seriously funny DVD signing. And Nico was with us, and she couldn't wake me up, so she ran to Wayne for help. He smacked the shit out of me until I got out of bed. I was still wasted, covered in vomit and urine. And Nico, that's when she won my devotion forever. Put me in the shower, dressed me, got me ready for the signing. I like to say that I do the same for her. I'll never know, because I'll drink her every time. But I arrived at the signing drunk and belligerent. Sat behind a folding table. A woman made her way over with a baby in one hand and a DVD in the other. I was like, hurry up, my mom got all day. I snapped. She approached nervously. I quickly signed her DVD and shot it. Now get that ugly baby out of here. I lost the ability to censor myself. To a guy who was lingering at the table, come on, man, nobody want to talk to you. Go back to your park bench. To a woman who was taking a photo with me, get your arm off me, lady. You look diseased. And the next person, look at those goddamn pants. I'm not signing no DVD for nobody wearing those stupid-ass pants. Take them off and go to the back of the line. And Nico kept trying to calm me down, but the fans just thought I was doing my act. Oh, my God, Kevin's so funny. He's crazy. I wish we had a tape that signing, because it could have been my next special. Laugh at my drunkenness. We were on fire with the challenges after that, until we bet John $2,000 that he couldn't finish a bottle of Hennessy without throwing up. When he passed out upside down in the rental car, vomited, wet himself, and almost died, it was a wake-up call to us all. From that day forward, we decided to stop doing bets that were hurting each other. Instead, we made bets to help each other. All the touring was killing Wayne slowly. He was 330 pounds and always sick. He had high blood pressure, sleep apnea, you name it. He snored so loudly that if he napped on a plane, the other passengers couldn't sleep. I said, let's make a bet right now. This is what I said to Wayne. I'll put up $10,000 to your $1,000 that you can't lose 40 pounds in the next 6 months. If you lose 50, I'll throw another $5,000 on top of it. Man, that ain't nothing. I can lose 60. Then I'll add another $5,000. Done. Wayne took off 60 pounds and kept going after that bet ended. I gladly paid him the $20,000. His entire lifestyle changed after that. Instead of money being a motivation for smart people to do stupid shit, I saw that money could be a motivation for stupid people to do smart shit as well. If that sounds like I'm being mean by calling Wayne stupid, he's earned it. He still owes me money, so I can call him whatever the fuck I choose. Wayne, if you're reading this, pay what you owe, and I remove this paragraph from the next printing of the book. John, you too. You owe me fucking money too, John. And for that, you're stupid. I'm watching y'all. And now so is every reader of this book. So they'll know if you both paid up when this paragraph disappears. But I'll bet you $100 it doesn't. Chapter 89. This chapter still gets me excited, people. Eventually, the time came for the big show. The one for movie theaters, the one for comedy history. I mean, I put $750,000 into this movie, making it the biggest bet I've ever made. The setting was Nokia Theater in Los Angeles. I scheduled 2 shows. That way I have a backup take of each joke. This ended up saving my ass. Because of everything at stake, I had so much on my mind that I spoke too quickly on the first night and parts fell flat. Afterward, I made adjustments, prayed, went back for show 2, and did one of the best sets of my life. No metaphors here, just gratitude. Can you believe this shit? This is what I asked the guys afterwards. We're going to get to go see this at a movie theater, man. At the end of the day, I'm still the excitable kid from Philadelphia who never got to do anything fun. Since much of the set was about my childhood, I returned to my old neighborhood to film a short documentary about the environment I grew up in. I wanted to show that the people and the places I spoke about were real. I went and had a meal at my cousin Cheryl and Preston's house. That's the same place where I was stuck in the kitchen snapping peas as a child. Most of my mom's family was there, and I was telling them that I wouldn't be who I was without them, and I started crying. I never told them why I got so choked up, but it's because my mom was the glue that held the family together. Since she passed, I realized that I barely spoken to our relatives, and I didn't want them to think that this meant that I didn't love them. Meanwhile, Will Packer was backing up his big talk with equally big actions. He introduced me, as promised, to Clint Culpepper, the head of Screen Gems, a production company responsible for thousands of films and shows. Clint somehow remembered me from a small part I'd done 2 years earlier in a drama about marriage and God based on a book by T.D. Jakes. It was called Not Easily Broken. My friend Morris Chestnut had gotten me the part of his new friend in Not Easily Broken, and now he ended up being casted in Think Like a Man, along with Romany Malco, who gotten the part I wanted for The 40-Year-Old Virgin. During the first day of filming, after I did a few takes that followed the script, the director, Tim Story, said, "Hey, man, we got you because you're funny. You got anything you want to try in this scene? Do this one for you." I knew from that moment that this would be a great experience, because he trusted me and wanted me to be the person I was on stage. So many of my films and pilots had gone wrong before because I wasn't given the freedom to express myself and follow my instincts. I'd spent the last 7 years on the road earning that freedom. From then on, after nearly every scene I did, Tim said, "Let's do a Kevin take." I came to think of these moments as being in my jello, because I had both support and wiggle room. Usually, these were the takes that ended up in the movie. For example, there's a scene where I mouth off to Ron Artest on the Lakers on the basketball court, and I improvise trying to snatch the ball out of his hand. He was strong enough to lift me up and dangle me in the air while I was still gripping the ball. It ended up being one of the most memorable scenes of the film. Everyone else on that set was also a team player. Nobody was selfish. Nobody wanted all the glory for themselves. In every scene, we tried to set each other up to look great. The whole process was comedy heaven. When the shoot ended, I had mixed emotions. On one hand, I felt like this might finally be the movie. But then I remembered so many disappointments before. A decade of dashed expectations, and tried to be careful not to get my hopes up again. While Think Like a Man was in post-production, I prepared for the release of Laugh for My Pain. AMC Theaters agreed to put my concert movie on 98 screens. My combined social media following had soared over 7 million, so I can now reach more people with a single tweet than with all those flyers that we'd ever handed out combined. I began promoting the film like there was no tomorrow. Which, by the way, is another expression that doesn't make sense, because if there was no tomorrow, then I wouldn't have needed to promote it. Nearly every post I made online ended with hashtag laughing my pain. I filled everyone's feed with the quotes from the movie and the questions for the fans until it became a trending topic. I worked with the same dedication offline like there was a tomorrow. I looked at the way movies were typically promoted. Press junkets, talk shows, interviews, billboards, and I decided once again to do something different that stood out. I got into this point in my career because I'm a people person. I love to engage with comedy fans and show appreciation for them. So I decided that even though this was a movie, it didn't mean that I couldn't mount an in-person charm offensive like I'd done in my early touring years. I popped up at as many theaters as I could just to simply buy tickets, popcorn, and drinks for people who were there to watch the movie. I thanked each person for coming, took pictures with them, and made it a memorable experience. Since so much of the film was about my dad, I brought him to the premiere where he proved everyone that I wasn't making anything up. Kept calling out the celebrities using their character names from TV. Gina! Gina, come here and take this photo, sucker! That's what he yelled at Tisha Campbell Martin. When she didn't respond, he got upset. Dad, that's just a character name she played on Martin. Okay, you gotta call her by her real name. Her name is Tisha. I'm sure she'll turn around. Oh, she's just one of them Hollywood people. Don't ever get like that, son, or I'll knock your ass out. In its first weekend, Laugh at My Pain sold $2 million in tickets. It was the 10th biggest film at the box office in that period, which was extremely rare for a stand-up comedy film with such a limited release. AMC put it on more screens the following week, and in the end, Laugh at My Pain went on to generate nearly $8 million at the box office. 7 months later, Think Like a Man hit theaters. Now, despite promising myself that I remain cautious, my hopes soared. It was a great book, script, cast, and director, and I felt like it was one of my best performances. I beat the streets up and I did surprise screenings, college events, everything I could think of. Think Like a Man hit number one at the box office on opening weekend, knocking down the Hunger Games. On a budget of $12 million, it ended up making $92 million, twice what the industry predicted. Sony Pictures is in shock. That's what the trade papers proclaim. It was not just an unbelievable success. It was a new beginning. And after hundreds of meetings and auditions and pitches, it all happened because of a guy I ran into at the airport. Life lessons from success. You don't need my advice anymore. You're successful. Then it's your turn to give the advice. Unless you lose your success, in which case, you got to start over at chapter one. Chapter 90. Hello, I'm back. It was a massive homecoming party. Every trade magazine in the industry was writing all about the success of Laugh at My Pain and Think Like a Man. Dave's phone was ringing off the hook. Interview offers came rolling in. I mean, most of the articles began something like, you probably never heard of Kevin Hart, but he is fast becoming one of the biggest comedians in the business. It showed me what a bubble Hollywood exists in. If more people bought tickets to my show than any other comedy tour that year, then how would it be possible for people not to have heard of me? What those journalists were really saying was that they have never heard of me. It had taken 7 years of touring to work my way back to being a newcomer in Hollywood. The difference was that before I was a newcomer with a dream. Now I was a newcomer with the leverage of an audience. Suddenly the people who didn't want to meet with me after Soul Plane in the big house wanted to have lunch. The seeds I had planted over the years grew into offers, and the other people who rejected me forgot they've ever turned me down. There were times when I'd sit in the meeting thinking, I'm not new. I've been here for years. Y'all don't remember? I was in here auditioning, and you cut me off and said, okay, that's enough, sir. It was a trip, but I didn't take it personally. Ultimately, casting me or any actor in a major role is an investment. And you don't want to put money into a company when it's peaked and it's on the way down. You want to get on board when it's on the way up. They were doing their jobs by looking for a safe investment, and I was doing mine by being one. Because I now controlled my career. I no longer had to make bad choices because I didn't have any other option or needed the money, or I was desperate to hear a yes. I could choose projects because I wanted to do them, and they were right for me. For most people, mixing desperation and decision-making is like mixing vodka and painkillers. It's a dangerous combination. As all those meetings, all the offers, all the let's make a deals, and we want to be in the Kevin Hart businesses, and our lawyers will call your lawyers, I decided to work with a true closer. Not just someone who would throw money or a good script at me, but someone who was willing to fight every step of the way to get a project made, released, and properly promoted. Someone whose work ethic I personally trusted. I'm talking about Will Packer. Why end a relationship that's working and growing? Will believed in me when I wasn't number one at the box office, and that was something that I would never get to experience in a new relationship again. In the meantime, there was a lot of other new things to experience on this ride, and everything was flying at warp speed. This is what it felt like. Oh my God, you want me to host all these award shows in front of all these people? Now after I have to host the award shows, now that you want me to take them in the back and I'm gonna go meet Chris Brown and everybody, I'm gonna tell them don't be friends, now they're friends again. I did that, I'm responsible for that, and I'm going to these auditions for these other movies, and I'm gonna do 5 seasons of sold out shows, and I'm gonna have Madison Square Garden, I'm gonna sell out shows in Madison Square Garden, and I'm gonna go and I'm gonna do bigger movies. Now that I'm done doing bigger movies, I'm gonna come back and I'm gonna do Saturday Night Live. Oh my God, I can't believe I host Saturday Night Live. Did that just happen? It really did just happen. Now that I'm having a drink, who am I having a drink with? Oh my God, Jay-Z, Beyonce, everybody's here. This is so crazy. I'm getting invited to all the parties, and look at this, now I'm doing this cool stuff. And now as I do the cool stuff, Clint Pope wants me to do some more business, and I'm doing more movies, and I got more friends, it just keeps on happening, nothing stopping, it just keeps going. Oh my God, I'm gonna do it for Ball Stadium. Why should I do it for Ball Stadium? I'm gonna do it for Ball Stadium. As I do, let me explain, then what now? Oh my God, it's so now, I don't want to, I'm becoming an international success. Look at this, international, oh my God, it's great, I've never been so busy, it's so great. Oh my God, my dad, I love my kids, I love my family, oh my goodness, and my life is going so fast. Now let me try to explain by slowing this down and breaking off a few of the most impactful pieces. Chapter 91. Keith, I'm in New York and I'm doing the garden, so who's the dummy now? When Will Packer came to me with a follow-up to Think Like a Man, I agreed to do it. But I told him that I needed to get back on the road first and stay connected with the comedy that had made the movies possible. When Laugh in My Pain was about my past, the new tour, Let Me Explain, it was a celebration of where I made it to from those twisted roots. How grateful I was to get there and my willingness to set the record straight on the rumors that had spread along the way. The tour sold 5 times as many tickets as Laugh in My Pain, filling over 500,000 seats in the end. The highlight of the Let Me Explain tour, and of this entire period of my life, was selling out 2 nights in Madison Square Garden in New York City. I reached out to 3 of the people I most admired, Jay-Z, Chris Rock, and Keith Robinson, who in so many ways made this possible, and asked if they could come to the show and share this moment with me. They were all down, except Keith, who had better things to do. Chris congratulated me, then shared some advice. It was a big world, so don't get stuck performing over and over for just one small piece of it. People in every country love to laugh. Get out of America and go tell your jokes to the world. Even though I was about to perform what I thought was a show of a lifetime, I saw how small my vision still was. I thought my comedy was universal because I was able to play for every type of crowd in America. And I'd done a few European shows, but I hadn't considered that what I thought was the world was just a tiny percentage of it. As I was in my dressing room with Chris, Jay-Z walked in, wearing 3 gold chains to my 1. This was a big moment for you. He nodded his head approvingly. A big moment. I said, no, it really is. You know how I know it's a big moment? I said, because you know where I came from? He said, no. Because I'm here. His words didn't seem arrogant. They were just true. This was my moment. Hove was in the house. It was all happening. Suddenly, my dad burst into the dressing room. Oh, man, that's Jay-Z right there. Nah, I got to get a goddamn picture. Motherfucking Jay-Z and Chris motherfucking Rock. Y'all motherfuckers, y'all got to give me a picture. He whipped out an old plastic camera from the 70s with a flash cube that he had to stick on top and thumb wheel that he spun to advance the film. He fiddled with it for a long time. Click, 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 click. Then started taking photos. Each one accompanied by a blinding flash. Click, 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 pop, click, 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 pop. Whatever magic the moment had was gone. We all slinked away politely. When I walked on stage that night, the applause thundered through the arena. I stood there and I took it all in. It was unbelievable. I'm happy I told the crowd. I want to explain why I'm happy. First of all, my divorce is final. A couple of months before the film came out, I was invited to host Saturday Night Live and promote it. 12 years after getting rejected by the show, I found myself crammed into Lorne Michaels' office with some 3 dozen writers and cast members working on an episode. The writers pitched their ideas to Lorne, and he narrowed them down to about 50 sketches, and a couple of days we ran through them all. For my monologue, I didn't want to give away the material from the movie, so I ended up sharing the story of my failed SNL audition. Spending that week working on the show reaffirmed my faith of the idea that everything happens for a reason. If I'd been added to the cast when I first auditioned and performed my horrible impressions on national television, I'd probably be selling sneakers today. When Let Me Explain came out of theaters, it was more than 4 times as successful as Laugh in My Pain, pulling in $32 million and reaching number 8 at the box office. What's harder than achieving success is achieving consistent success. But what's even harder than achieving consistent success is achieving consistently bigger success. The reverberations of that second concert film took me to the next level. Because now I was respected, not just in comedy circles and Hollywood circles, but in business circles. The first thing I found at the next level was script stalkers. Before this, people used to just hand me scripts. But now they were threatening me with scripts. A few guys had set up meetings with networks by claiming to work with Heartbeat Productions. Another script stalker reached out to everyone in my crew, and when that didn't work, went after all the family members. Even hiring Joey's son to work at a DJ in order to hand him a script for me. The creepiest stalker of them all kept popping up backstage at concerts with fake credentials and pretending to be part of the entourage. I once caught him harassing Nico, trying to get her to convince me to make his movie. We eventually had to take out restraining orders on a few of these guys. The lesson is that you can hustle all you want, but you're not going to get anywhere if you're hustling with a delusional mind. The most disappointing thing about making it as a comedian, I told Nico afterwards, was repeating something Chris Rock once said, is that you don't get sex groupies like rappers and athletes. You get business groupies. Chapter 92. Still having trouble with this particular life lesson. This is the point where in most memoirs, celebrities reveal how they sabotage their rising fame and success. The flaws in their character become magnified by the spotlight, and they start messing with the drug and develop an addiction that takes them back down to the bottom. That's pretty much what happened to me. The drug I was hooked on was a very powerful one. The kids these days call it the Xbox. I had already experimented with some Madden, which turned out to be the gateway drug to the hardest stuff of all time. NBA 2K. Jesus Christ, this is strong stuff. I've been touring for so long with these Plaza Cup boys that we've grown tired of clubs and after parties. Most of us were in serious relationships, and our tolerance for the bullshit had faded to zero. After every show, we meet backstage and we begin the ritual. Yo, let's go to the hotel room. Y'all set up the game? Yeah, let's play. Hey, who's got the records? I got them. Did y'all set up the profiles? I bet 500 I'm gonna beat your ass with only Dirk and the whiskey. With everything I get into, I don't have a halfway setting. It's all or nothing. I have to either be the best or give everything I've got trying. Soon we were taking our Xbox and the TV to the arenas and setting them up in the green room so we could play before and after each show. People would come backstage to party with us and just end up watching us shout and argue and cut each other down as we played NBA 2K. When we were kicked out of the arena, we rushed to the hotel, the bus, or the plane as quickly as we possibly could just to get back to playing the game. Often we sit up playing all night. I remember looking up at one point and saying, yo, we've been playing this goddamn game for 16 hours. Addiction is a nasty disease. Your tolerance builds up, and soon you need a bigger, more dangerous high. We eventually found that high. Guts! Guts is a fast-paced poker game in which players are dealt a hand of 2 to 4 cards. We each have the option of either saying guts, that's if we think that we got the best hand, or folding. You fold if you don't. Because of the way that the betting works, if 5 people say guts, the pot can quadruple in 1 round. This game is fast-paced, and the money changes hands rapidly. So we started keeping a record book and settling our debts with each other at the end of the tour. Now, I don't have a better way to explain what goes on in a game of guts other than to bring you into a game of one that's going on right now. It's on a private plane somewhere over Fresno. Wayne goes, this fucking game. John's head is going to hurt when he sees the $5,000 tab he got. I said, look, I'll just take it out of his pay. Let him run up the tab forever. It don't matter to me. I'll eventually get what he owes me. Spank said, well, I owe him $3,000. He's the only one that don't pay, so that's why I'm not paying him. Bank goes, I don't care. I don't give a shit. You can put this in a book. Shit, you want to fucking write it? Write it. I don't care. I don't care. I ain't going to read the fucking book anyway. Wayne jumped in. Hey, remember that time on the last day of the tour when you went to the bank and you got 30 grand to settle with everybody? Spank didn't like it, but he had to admit, yeah. I pulled out 5,000 and I started playing. Then I got out the rest and I lost it all before I got the chance to pay anybody what I owed. Your wife must want to kill you for doing all this with your salary. Well, she don't know. She has no idea that I even have this type of cash. That's when Wayne jumped in. And let me tell you something. If you think that any of them tell their girlfriends or wives what these pots get up to, hell no. They ain't that fucking stupid. Yeah. Spank jumped in and said, yeah, man, you can only tell the women about the wins. You can't tell them about the losses. That's when Naeem jumped in. I stopped playing as soon as I noticed that the person who needs the money the least always wins. all heads just turn and somehow just start looking at me. What? I'm a lucky guy. That's why you all roll with me, because I'm lucky. Just for the record, I love to gamble with my team because that's how I get my money back. They're dumb enough to do it, so I allow them. They're paid very well. These guys make great money. But I get a good percentage of it back on those planes going to and from these events. But let's just keep that between us. Shh. Can somebody say secret? I told you guys I know how to keep them. Tight-lipped is what I am. They'll never know. See, understand this. I'm the type of guy that Las Vegas was built for because I'm an optimist. Someone who's practical, like Naeem. Naeem will make a little money at blackjack table, and then he'll stop. He'll look around the giant, luxurious casino, and then he'll see that it was built by people's losses. Me? No. I don't see that. See, I make a lot of money, and I keep going because I think it's my lucky day, and nothing can stop me, so I need to go bigger. And every time I go bigger, I lose it all. Yeah, I lose it all. See, when I go to Vegas today, the casinos love me. They give me free panoramic penthouse suite with a jacuzzi and assign me a complimentary host. I feel so damn important. But when I leave, I realize I've lost enough money at the casino to book that free room for the entire year and pay the complimentary host a salary and benefits. I'm always leaving casinos pointing to the chandeliers and couches and telling the staff, I just paid for that. So you're welcome. I tell my kids that working hard earns you the right to play hard. No matter what happened in this intense period of my life, work always came first. But just because you work smart doesn't give you the right to play stupid. And I played stupid. I played real stupid. I could have lost everything I worked for because of one mistake I kept making and not learning from. Chapter 93, Alcohol. When I'm drunk, I think everything is a toilet. Now, this doesn't mean that I'll go to the bathroom just anywhere. I'm not an animal. I don't even like to touch the door handle on the way out of a public bathroom. I mean, I've seen Spank ignore the soap dispenser, wet his hands, and then dry him on his pants one too many times. You can only imagine how many dick handles is out there. Yeah. You just shaking off and grabbing knobs. I don't want to touch that dick handle. But when I'm wasted, anything with a door looks like a bathroom to me. And anything with a lid or an opening looks like a toilet. So I'll piss wherever I think a bathroom is or should be. I peed behind a bar in my house because I thought it was a urinal. I peed in the hotel closet one time. Yeah, I think I was walking into a bathroom. That's what I thought. Like, oh, this got to be a bathroom. And I just fucking peed. I've even peed in my daughter's potty, which is very practical. That's not a bad situation at all. It's a potty. At least it was a potty. Okay? So technically, I was half right, half wrong on that one. I can honestly say that one time in Vegas, I pissed into Nico's purse. And I remember saying to myself, oh, it's a toilet with a zipper. I got it. I just unzipped this piece, and I'm good to go. I wonder when they started making these. When they started making these fancy zipper toilets. I gotta get one of these for the house. In the morning, Nico was furious. Why'd you piss in my bag? I'm just talking about, I ain't pee in your bag. Yes, you did. She showed me the inside of her purse. Everything was soggy and smelled like asparagus. I promise I'll never do it again. A week later, I pissed in her Louis Vuitton luggage. Damn it. I fucking broke my promise. Another time, I got out of bed, walked to the bathroom, lifted the toilet seat, peed, and then put the seat back down for Nico. Then I went back to bed, feeling good about having been so considerate. I woke up the next morning in a puddle of my own piss. Turned out that whole trip to the toilet is what happened in my head. Yeah. I was so drunk that I thought I was in the bathroom, and I wet the bed. Now, if you want to know what birthday present to get for a comedian who seems to have everything, the answer in this particular case is rubber sheets. Yeah, I would have been very happy with that. Now, despite what you may be thinking right now, I didn't have a drinking problem. Drinking had a problem with me. See, the difference is that someone with a drinking problem abuses alcohol. In my situation, the alcohol abused me. I only drank when I was out with my friends, which was all the time, because who goes out with enemies? And I never felt like I got drunk. Alcohol impairs people in different ways, and with me, it impaired my ability to tell that I was drunk. No matter how many shots I did, still thought I was sober. Even if I was vomiting, I think I caught the flu from someone at the bar. I'd only find out how drunk I was the next morning when an ego told me where I pissed. Okay, this is turning into a problem. So it wasn't like I was the angry drunk. I was a pissy drunk. Drunk and fucked with my bladder. Okay? I wasn't a crazy guy. I just fucking piss. I piss wherever when I'm drunk. Because of this, I get behind the wheel after a few drinks, and I think that I was completely sober and perfectly fine to drive. Let me tell you guys, the best thing that ever happened to me was getting a DUI. Now, this isn't funny in any way, because I could have killed somebody. It's actually disgusting to think of the number of times that I've woken up in a parking lot of a drive-thru with a half-eaten burger in my lap, thinking, oh shit, I'm still fucking here. I almost killed myself at Dennis Rodman's one night. We were driving down the hill, and I fell asleep at a stop sign. My mother, or some angel who protects assholes, must have been looking out for me, because when I woke up, my foot was still on the brake. If it wasn't, we would have rolled down that hill, smashed into someone's house, and North Korea would have lost the only American that it liked. The same angel was looking out for me the night I crashed into a fence and a metal pole speared straight through the engine of my Range Rover. The car was still running, so I just reversed it, sputtered into the street, kept on driving. I forgot about the accident, and so I saw smoke billowing from the hood. When the engine died, I examined it and called AAA. Hey, I need help. Someone stuck a sword or something into my engine. It's obviously a knight. A knight obviously attacked me, and he put a sword in my engine. Next thing I knew, I was woken up by firefighters knocking on the window and yelling, "You sleeping in the middle of the highway?" It was amazing they didn't call the police, and then no one turned me in a few weeks later when I crashed into a highway median, left the car there, took a taxi home. The fuck are you doing, Kevin? That's what I thought when I saw my car smashed against the concrete median early the next morning. Are you trying to really fuck your life up? Is that what you're really trying to do? But it took the DUI to really wake me up. I was on a freeway driving home from a club with Nico, and she was trying to lower my pants. I veered a few times outside of the lane, and in the process, we got lit up. Whoop, whoop. Started to pull over, figured I'd deal with the inconvenience, and then we go home to pick up where we left off. My next thought was, I gotta put both my hands on the wheel in plain sight. But my pants are down. How can I pull them up without getting my junk blown off? Fortunately, the cop told me to pull off at the next exit, which gave me enough time to get myself situated. I pulled you over because you were swerving all over the road, the officer said, taking my license and registration. Have you been drinking? No, sir. I'm leaving the club. I had a good time, that's all. Sir, step out the car. What? I stepped out the car. Put your hands behind your back. Wait a minute. Shit. No. Hold on. I put my hands behind my back, and he snapped my handcuffs over my Rolex tri-color special edition masterpiece watch with a diamond dial. I started one obsessive collection since the money started coming in, and this was watches. This Rolex tri-color special edition masterpiece with a diamond dial happened to be my favorite. So I requested, as politely as possible, "Sir, can you please be careful of my watch with those handcuffs?" He tightened the cuffs up two more clicks, directly over the dial. I thought maybe he hadn't heard me, or didn't understand how important this piece was to me. "Sir, could you be a little more careful with the handcuffs? That's a Rolex tri-color special edition masterpiece with a diamond dial." He twisted the key in the handcuffs and loosened them. Just as I was thanking him, he clicked them down tight again, directly over the Rolex tri-color special edition masterpiece. Right away, I knew he'd scratched the diamond dial. Inigo saw the look on my face, "Babe, don't say nothing." She begged me. I said something. I said, "Dude, I just asked you not to do that. Stop resisting arrest." The cop shoved me hard against his car. "Please, officer, just let him go." Inigo half begged, half cried. Then to me, "Babe, just do what he wants." Now, in my tequila-soaked mind, the guy was a bully and I wasn't going to get pushed around by a cop abusing his power. But the truth was, if I were in his position, and there was a rich drunk asshole who cared more about his Rolex tri-color special edition masterpiece and his diamond dial than about the lives that he was endangering on the freeway, I'd probably do the same or worse. "Oh, so you're that guy," I went on with my dumb self, "going out every night to take out your shitty life on everyone you pull over. Oh, I'm coming along peacefully, so don't hate on me just because you don't have my life. Nobody's worried about your life, sir. I just don't like assholes. So I'm an asshole now, because I tell you to be careful with my watch? No, what makes me an asshole is when you run this registration to see if this car ain't leased. It's owned." I was already a stupid asshole for driving intoxicated, but now I was a Hollywood asshole for bragging intoxicated. Inigo was hysterical. "Stop, shut up. Just do what he wants you to do." The cop looked ready to beat my ass right on the side of that highway. "Go ahead, take me to jail," I went on with my stupid Hollywood asshole mouth. "I'll be out in a couple hours. His partner brought over a breathalyzer and interrupted my tirade. We need you to blow. Fuck no. I'm not blowing. I know the law. Why would I blow? I ain't blowing. Just take me to jail. I turned to Inigo. Babe, just drive the car home and I'll see you later. She's been drinking too? Unless she wants to join you in jail, she better find another way home. So you gonna make me leave my lady out here? I would suggest you figure out a way to get her home safely. He pushed me into the squad car, and it quickly became apparent that he wasn't going to be taking my suggestion. Babe, call somebody! That's what I yelled pathetically after Inigo. They took the keys and left Inigo standing on the curb near the freeway exit ramp. Inigo shouted, Babe, I'll come get you! At the precinct, some of the officers recognized me. Have you been drinking, Mr. Hart? One of them asked. Yes. I'm not gonna blow, though. All right, so why don't you just go sleep a little, and then we'll figure out what you want to do. I slept for a few hours, and then I blew. I was past the legal limit, which is 0.08%. But it was better than what would have happened if I had blown the first time. That shit would have come in a goddamn 0.8 or something crazy. When they released me from jail the next morning, I still wasn't sober. Inigo, who ended up calling Wayne to drive her and the Mercedes home, came to the station to meet me. As I walked with her to the car and felt the sun on my face, a TMZ cameraman came running up. Hey, what exactly happened, dude? He said the police report claimed I was driving over 90 miles an hour and I almost hit a gas tanker. I couldn't remember a gas tanker. So either the cop made that up or I'm an idiot. Actually, either way, I'm an idiot. If I'd had any chance of hiring a good lawyer to get these charges dismissed, I lost it with my response. I was actually drunk, so there's no arguing that. I never attempted to fight the charge or make it into a racist cop incident. It was a dickhead incident. Two guys on the side of the 101 freeway competing to see who could be the biggest dick. Well, I won that. Ended up costing me a lot of work, including a Bud Light deal worth $10 million. But I look back on the arrest today and I think I'm a better, smarter man because this happened. If it hadn't happened, I might have kept drinking and driving until I killed someone. Sometimes it takes experiencing consequences to your actions for you to learn that they're wrong. And by then, it's often too late. Because of that night in jail, I learned my lesson and quit altogether. I stopped driving. I still drank, but I hired a driver to get me home afterwards. He quit when I pissed in his hat, by the way. That first guy quit. And it was an honest mistake. His hat was in the back when I was drinking. He doesn't know about my problem. I'm talking about the pissing problem. Chapter 94, From the Heart. After getting that DUI, my commitment to health and fitness truly began. I wanted to be a better person for Nico and for my children, and that meant taking better care of myself. I started rising earlier in the morning, eating healthier, putting myself on a strict schedule, and working out more regularly and systematically. As my body became stronger and healthier, my mind became stronger and healthier as well. I began to clearly see all the ways I was at fault for the destruction of my relationship with Tori. The constant infidelity, the dishonesty, and negative talk. And, as the man in the situation, no matter what she was doing to me physically, it was never okay for me to put hands on her. That's a shame that I have to bear for the rest of my life. These were the actions of a weak man. Morally weak, emotionally weak, physically weak, everything weak. Tori noticed the change in me. When I was on the phone trying to get more time with the kids, I no longer got mad when she refused to let me take them for a weekend trip. Other times, she'd say something that felt cruel to me, and I wouldn't react. I just rationally let her know that I disagreed with the statement. I was as surprised by this new me as she was. A relationship is a system created by two people, so when there's a shift in one person, there's inevitably a shift in the other. Instead of battling on the phone, Tori and I began doing something we'd rarely done for a decade. Speaking with instead of against each other. It became clear that I had been fighting to deprive Heaven and Hendrick of a mother, and she had been fighting to deprive them of a father. The only people we were hurting in this battle were two people who mattered most, our children. Now, we may not have learned to like each other, but we at least learned to tolerate, respect, and accept each other. From that starting point and through many more conversations, we were able to get to a place where we could actually co-parent in a way that was healthy for our children without ever going to court to battle for custody. And what was that way? It was simply and finally putting the kids' needs above our own. If I wanted them to come hang out with me on set for a month over the summer, we were able to discuss that in a way that was about what was best for them, not about what was wrong with me or unfair to her. The day we made this shift was the day we grew up and became good parents. It took years of separation and divorce to bring us closer together, but today I put Tori on a pedestal because she's their mother, and I will never knock her off of that. Even if she makes a decision that I disagree with, I'll never contradict her in front of the kids. At most, I may tell them whatever is right or wrong in this particular case, that's how your mom feels. This way, they see me respecting their mother in the same way I expect them to respect her. After all we've been through, it's amazing to write those words. I supported Tori beyond what the courts ordered. I bought her a house, a truck, and as much as possible so that the kids feel as comfortable and have as many opportunities in her world as in mine. In the meantime, Tori has come to develop a cordial relationship with Eniko and has accepted her as a loving part of the kids' lives. Running parallel to my entire comedy career, there's been a relationship career that took just as long and just as much work to succeed in. My kids have never seen Eniko and me fight or argue in any way. I'm not proud that it took me so long to create a healthier environment for my kids, but I am proud that I've matured and showed them what adult relationships should look like. Once when I said something that unintentionally hurt Eniko's feelings, Heaven dropped into my lap and said, "Daddy, are you and Miss Eniko upset with each other? You both been quiet." I was a little upset. "You know what? I'm about to go out and apologize." "Yes, please do that, Dad." "Okay, I'll go apologize now." It touched my heart to see how important it was to her that we got along. At the same time, it broke my heart to know why that was so important to her. I'm determined to dedicate the rest of my life to repairing whatever damage the past may have done to them. Chapter 95, in which I learned that there's a giant gap between what you imagine yourself doing and what you're capable of doing, and it hurts pretty bad when you fall into that gap. In the 2.5 years after Think Like a Man, Will Packer and I went on to make 4 more films together. I had a functional home family, I had a dysfunctional role family, and now I had a supportive set family. Despite all the meetings I was taking, I kept working with Will because the relationship was thriving and the films kept getting bigger. The project that most excited me was Ride Along with Ice Cube, who, like me, had worked hard and on his own terms to break into the film business as an outsider. It was an action comedy, which I thought meant that I'd get to shoot people and jump off buildings and blow shit up. So I was disappointed to learn that they hired me, a stunt double, to do all the fun stuff instead of me. Why do you need someone else? We're just jumping off a hill onto that rail, right? Oh, I can do that. Crew members glanced at each other and rolled their eyes as I tried to talk my way into doing my first stunt. Oh, I recognize that look, because it's the same one of my friends give each other when I'm gambling and say, "I'm on the street. Hey, let me just play one more hand." Finally, Tim Story signed and gave in. "Please, Kevin, just don't hurt yourself, man." I began doing my own stunts whenever I could, until we shot a scene where I was supposed to jump, land on my back, roll, and pop back up in the classic action hero move. But as soon as I hit the ground, my spine connected with the floor so hard that the camera operators winced. I jumped up like I hadn't hurt myself because I was too proud to admit it. Clearly, there was a craft to this work the stuntman knew and I didn't. "Nice. Let's get one more take like that." That's what Tim said. "You know what, Tim? Why don't we just have a stuntman do this one? You know, just so we can get a different version of it. You sure, Kevin?" From that moment on, every time there was an action scene, I was the first one saying, "All right, where's the stuntman? There he is. I see him right there. Eating hot dogs. Somebody tell him to put the hot dog down. Let's bring him over. It's fine. Hey, I don't need to do this one." When it came time to plan the marketing for Ride Along, I sat down with Universal, who were distributing the film, by the way. Chris Rock's advice rang in my head, and I asked him to let us travel internationally to promote the movie. I'm not saying throw a bunch of money at it, but let me go overseas and try to sell this product. If I can get an introduction to these countries, I'll be able to go and build up a fan base and tour in more places, which will also help our future movies together. Universal let Cube and me travel to Europe and Australia to do media and promotion, and everyone won. With a budget of only $25 million, Ride Along held down the number one spot at the box office for 3 weeks and went on to make $150 million domestically and $20 million internationally. The next 2 films that Will and I did together, The Wedding Ringer and Think Like a Man 2, went respectively to number 2 and 1 at the box office on their opening weekends. And soon, instead of being the newcomer, I was the guy that everyone couldn't get rid of. I was an overnight success that was only 16 years in the making. Chapter 96. Can't stop, won't stop, can't stop, won't stop, can't stop, won't stop, won't stop, can't stop, can't stop, won't stop, won't stop. On Patterson Avenue in Philadelphia, there's a landmark that casts its shadow over the city. I've seen it on television. I've been there many times, and on a hot, humid Sunday, I was there again, but in the spot that I'd never set foot in before. I sit in the center of the Lincoln Financial Field and crane my neck, looking at four ascending levels of seating that bottled out the city and the freeway in all directions. This is where Philly sports fans have come for years to worship the Eagles like a religion. When Chad Lewis made the ankle-breaking catch that won them the NFC title game in 2005. Where Donovan McNabb threw the last-minute 28-yard pass that came to be known as the 4th and 26. And where in just a few hours, 53,000 people would be coming to see one man tell jokes. It was the climax of the What Now Tour, which wasn't even over and had already become the highest grossing comedy tour in history. My thoughts turned to my mother. She'd never come to a show of mine, but I knew that she would have been at this one. Somewhere, in some way, I felt she would still be watching tonight to see her son become the first comedian to ever sell out an NFL football stadium. When I talk of my accomplishments and my work ethic, it's so that she will hear and smile knowing all the hardship that she suffered to keep me from throwing my life away was not in vain. That night, illuminated by millions of watts of lighting, I stood on stage and talked about a life I never thought I'd have. A soulmate I was on the verge of marrying. Two beautiful children who turn out happy against all odds. A house where I can provide all things for my kids that I never had. Like actually rooms to themselves. My father, who I once thought would die on the streets, visiting the grandchildren who love and adore him. Renting a motorboat for a family vacation and driving it without crashing into anything. Every story to me was a small miracle. After the show, I donated several $100,000 from ticket sales to build playgrounds around Philadelphia in my mother's name. Especially in the forgotten, decaying areas where she struggled to find safe ways to keep me busy. My hope is that her name lives on forever in the city just like her spirit does. After the show, I had one more big hurdle to cross. The ocean. I've been to a few foreign countries, but I never left the so-called Western world. I was scared of getting arrested and thrown in the prison with just hole in the dirt to shit in. I was scared of getting a rare disease that would make my blood hot enough to cook me from the inside. I was scared of getting captured by terrorists and my beheading becoming number one on the jihad box office. All I knew is what I read. I didn't have any experience. I debated whether or not to go to these parts of the world until finally I said, fuck it. If I want to be global, that means I need to actually go all over the globe. Before leaving for my overseas dates, I went to go see the doctor who told me that I needed to get a bunch of shots to protect me from a disease like yellow fever and hepatitis B. I reconsidered my ambitions. I asked him, I said, hey, do I absolutely need those? Doctor told me yes. By injecting you with the small amounts of these viruses, you'll produce antibodies to prevent you from getting sick over there if you're infected. Okay, so let me get this straight. So you're saying that you're going to give me yellow fever now, so if I catch it over there, I'm immune to it because I got it. Yes, that's basically how it works. Well, why can't I go over there without the virus, not catch it, and come back okay? Or go over there, catch it, come back, and then you give me the antidote so I can get it out of my body. Well, Ms. Hart, you won't be experiencing any symptoms with these shots. It's just a low-grade version of the virus. Okay, but I don't know if you follow me or not. Why would I want the disease in my body? That's my question. I mean, if I told you I was going to go out with someone who had herpes, you say, wait, come in and see me so I can give you herpes first? Is that what you're telling me? No, Mr. Hart, these are standard immunizations that all travelers get. Well, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, if you give me the shot, I have 100% chance of getting the disease. But if I don't get the shot, there's still a chance I might not get it, right? See, it's like telling me you're going to break my leg so when I go play soccer, I'll be used to getting my leg broke. No, man, no, I'm not letting y'all mentally manipulate me into thinking that this makes sense. I'm rolling the dice. If I get sick, then you just better fix it when I come back. The trip took me to Africa and the Middle East for the first time, learning about the apartheid, seeing where the marches took place, and going to Nelson Mandela's jail cell was a powerful history lesson, teaching me that it is never wrong to fight for what is right. Along the way, I learned the fears and stereotypes I had about other countries were nonsense. Outside of minor differences that were all surface level and all cool to learn about, people there were just like people here. Life there was just like life here. So much ignorance comes from a lack of experience, and these trips showed me that we are all brothers and sisters. And we need to always remember that, because if one person is hurting, then we all are hurting. The most amazing part of the tour, besides not getting sick, was visiting the royal family of the Bafokeng people. They gave me an African name. It was Umpo, which means gift. See, we give it to you because you have the gift of making other people laugh. That's what they told me. This symbol givers brought me to places I never expected to go, giving me just about everything I have and taught me most of what I know, but only because I never gave up on it. Everybody wants success in something, whether it's in work, love, play, finances, family, or an inner struggle. But success doesn't come instantly. Life has a process of rejecting you to test you and prepare you to win. Steve Harvey lived in his Ford Tempo and showered in gas stations when he couldn't get enough comedy gigs to cover his rent. Halle Berry slept in a homeless shelter in New York when she was auditioning to become an actress. Even James Cameron, one of the richest directors in Hollywood, was reduced to living out of his car when he was trying to sell the screenplay for The Terminator. The list goes on and on. How you handle rejection is very similar to how you handle success. If you're strong enough to handle rejection without taking it personally, without holding a grudge, and without losing your passion and drive, then you'll be strong enough to reap the rewards. But if you're too weak to handle failure and disappointment, then you're too weak to handle success, which will only end up damaging your life and happiness. If life is a struggle, then struggle. If you get rejected again. If your dreams are smashed, then keep dreaming. Just keep your eyes on the prize. And always remember that you gotta fail to win. Unless you're at a blackjack table in Las Vegas with me. In which case, that you should remind me that this advice applies only to games that aren't rigged and that the Bellagio doesn't need any more fountains. Epilogue. Life lessons from legacy building. One day you won't be here, but your legacy will. Even if the earth is gone, you contributed to that. If you'd done something different, maybe the planet would have survived another minute, another year, another millennium. Everything you do matters, so treat it like it matters. Chapter 97. Building newer, better models. Growing up, the best thing I ever had was nothing. All the experiences I disliked in my childhood, sleeping in the hallway, not having a car, and being too poor to afford a haircut, were essential to building my character. I remember going to the homes of other kids and looking around with envy. You got grass? What? Wait, you got steps inside your house? And you got two bathrooms? My kids would never have that experience. One of the first challenges I faced when I began earning enough money to overprovide for myself and my kids was how to raise them with the same qualities my mother instilled in me. Because if you give kids whatever they want, you create monsters who go out into the world and say, "Gimme." And the world says no. However, when your children are flying on private planes and traveling with daddy's security guards, they can quickly lose their grounding in reality. So I constantly tell Heaven and Hendrix about my childhood. While we're fortunate to have this lifestyle, and in no way, shape, or form, are they on easy street for life. Nothing's been given to us, I explain. Everything that we have came from hard work. You're part of it because you're my kids, but when you're no longer kids, it's up to you to get your own stuff. You don't have to be your dad, but you're going to have your dad's will, and you're going to know that whatever you put your mind to, you can achieve. One of my biggest regrets is taking my education and opportunities for granted in my youth and being content with just barely getting by. Today I often think, damn, what if? What if I put 100% into learning when I was growing up? Maybe I would have accomplished more. What if I'd gone to the University of Pennsylvania? Maybe I've been able to add professors to the front of my name. What if I'd given more of a shit about the swim team? Maybe I could have been the first black man under 5'5" to win an Olympic gold medal for swimming. I will never know the answer to these questions because I fucked off parts of my life and shut certain doors that were open for me. As a father, I'm dedicated to making sure that my children don't have the same regrets. Our conversation about it usually goes like this. Baby, why'd you get a B? I don't know, Dad. Class was tough for me. How'd you do in math? Were you good? Nope. What'd you get? A lot lower than a B. So sometimes, is it okay to get lower than a B? Nope. Why not, Dad? You did, because your job is to be better than me. Getting a B is fine, but you should never be content with a B. You should always wonder why you didn't get an A. Because you know what happened to Daddy? that he got lucky and stumbled into something that he had no idea would end up working out like it did. You don't have to get lucky. You can know what you want to do and walk straight into it. Do you understand? I do, Dad. I don't want to disappoint you. I'm never disappointed. I want